compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, we're back. The first hour went by very fast. If you missed any of it, you missed a lively program and some wonderful calls. Go back and listen by going to your Relevant Radio app or go to relevantradio.com/Patrick about an hour after the program is over and it'll be up there. The phone number is 888-914-9149 and you are invited to call 888-914-9149. Let's go to Steve in San Antonio. Good morning, Steve, and thank you for waiting.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for the excellent work that you always do.
Thank you.
My question is relating to responsibility for sin. And if we look at Judas, when he betrayed Jesus, and we think about what he actually did, he did not harm Jesus in any way. He simply told the Jewish leaders where to find Jesus. And yet Jesus said that it is better for that person if he were never born. Mm-hmm. If we fast forward now to today, and we look specifically at abortion, where the church has ruled that a woman who gets an abortion is automatically excommunicated from the church. Mm-hmm. And we look at what we're doing, and do we have some responsibility in that? And by that, I mean, I'm not committing an abortion or encouraging anyone to commit an abortion. But if I vote for a politician who I know is going to be doing everything he can to advance the abortion cause, am I in fact committing a sin by voting for this person? And how should we handle that?
Yes, well, I believe I understand your question. Correct me if I don't. But if you're asking me, does somebody who votes for a pro-abortion politician, knowing and even perhaps because of that position, does the voter have some connection to that sin? Yes, the answer would be yes, insofar as there is a, even though it's a somewhat remote participation, it's a direct and intentional participation in abortion. It's seeking to put someone in office who will advance the cause of abortion. So if I understood your question correctly, that would be my answer to that. Did I get your question correctly?
Yes. And if I may have a follow-up question.
Sure.
And the follow-up question is that if I'm ignorant of that connection, I don't understand that, hey, just me voting for an abortion proponent is in fact a sin. Whose responsibility is it to educate the lay people, the Christian Catholic lay people, that in fact you are committing a sin?
Okay. Well, let's see. You got a couple questions there. Let me try to get them both. First of all, who's responsible for, and as, let me say it a different way. Who's responsible for forming one's conscience? Now, the most responsible person is the person himself. So you and I, let's just take you, Steve. Ultimately, the person most responsible for the formation of your conscience is you. Now, there are secondary people who are responsible at a certain sense. You know, your parents as you were being raised, your school teachers have a certain obligation. Society in general and in a variety of ways has a kind of obligation to do that. But ultimately, it's the person himself who has to listen to his conscience, but he also has to have a properly formed conscience. So I would say there are layers of responsibility leading up to the one who's most responsible being Steve in San Antonio or Patrick, you know, in Columbus, Ohio kind of thing. Now, I have a feeling maybe you might be alluding to the bishops and the priests. Is that part of your question, kind of an unspoken part of the question?
Well, just, you know, there's so much effort put into combating abortion. You know, you think about Priests for Life, you think about all the organizations that do so much good work and backbreaking work to try and put an end to abortion. Mm-hmm. And I can't help thinking that, you know, if the priest stood up in the pulpit and said, hey guys, I'm not telling you who to vote for, but a reminder, if you vote for abortion proponents, it is a sin.
Mm-hmm. Some priests have done that. Some bishops have done that, thankfully. And I'm grateful for the courageous efforts on their part to speak out. I mean, if you may know this, Steve, there's a sort of a bit of a kerfuffle going on right now among the bishops in the United States, because the vast majority of them, it seems, they want to have a discussion and act on their instincts to apply the remedy that's foreseen in canon law to not allow a pro-abortion politician to receive communion. And then there seems to be a small minority of bishops who are opposed to that for their own reasons. Even there, we don't have a kind of united front or a unanimity when it comes to how best to go about doing that. And I've seen any number of examples where a bishop or a priest more commonly stands up and says this, and they get pilloried. And people write angry letters to their bishop, and people go on the war path, and he's telling me to be a Republican, or he's telling me to vote for whatever. And so it's a very, it's such an electrified topic now that no matter what the priest says, if he's speaking up in favor, or rather in defense of unborn human life, it's going to create a backlash. And I wonder if maybe in some cases, you know, I don't necessarily think it's the best answer, but in some cases, maybe they're not as vocal as they might want to be because they realize the retaliation that would be brought against them. I don't know.
Right, right. Well, thank you for the answer, and thank you for again for the excellent work you do, and please do keep it up.
Thank you, Steve. I'm here because you're there. You're listening, and I sure appreciate that. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Carmen listening in Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Carmen.
Oh, good morning. First of all, I'd like to add, you said to be nice to flight attendants. Yes, you're right. It goes a long way.
Are you a flight attendant?
I'd also like, yeah.
So you know, right?
I am.
Yeah.
And I love nice people, absolutely. My question, Patrick, is I love to say the rosary, and I am especially doing better now saying it more regularly because of Relevant Radio.
That's good.
My question is it wrong or disrespectful to wear my rosary as a necklace? I heard years ago that you should not do that. And I've also seen some beautiful t-shirts that have been for sale that have like the picture of the Virgin Mary or mm-hmm. or something religious. And mm-hmm. I want to know if that's okay.
Okay. Well, let's say you're wearing the rosary out of devotion and you just want to be reminded of your devotion to Our Lady, and you have it around your neck, and whether it's visible or not, I would not think that would be any problem at all. If you're, on the other hand, Madonna or a rap singer or some other, let's say, person in music or in media, and you're wearing it as a maybe a form of mockery, or you're wearing it simply as a an ornament and you're not taking it seriously, yeah, I think that would be a misuse of it. And that could even rise to the level of a sin because it could be blasphemous even. I don't need to go into some of the ways that could be possible. But yeah, I mean, it could be sinful under the wrong circumstances, but it doesn't sound like what you're describing would fit in that regard.
Wonderful. Wonderful. What about the t-shirts that I've seen that they sell?
Religious
pictures. Mm-hmm.
I think that's fine. I mean, if you are wearing a t-shirt that shows Our Lady or Jesus or some holy person, and you're doing so out of respect and a desire to sort of let other people see that, I think that's good. There's nothing wrong with that inherently.
Wonderful.
If somebody were to wear it, let me give you an example. I've seen on the interwebs examples where people have photoshopped images of Jesus in the Sacred Heart, you know, and he's standing there with his mm-hmm. hand up, or he's pointing to his heart or something. And then they will photoshop some ridiculous face where his face was, or they will use, you know, I've seen this happen where you may see like a crown of thorns, and inside the crown of thorns, you have Jesus suffering, and his hand is you know, pointing to his heart, the inflamed Sacred Heart of Jesus, and they'll put some comedian's face on there. That's blasphemous.
Oh,
that would
awful.
Be sinful. Yeah. Yes. So people can go in that direction, sadly, and they would be blaspheming God. But what you're talking about is not that. I think it's entirely fine.
Okay.
That's my opinion. But I think that if you call up Pope Francis when you hang up with me, call him up. I have a feeling he'll agree with me. Yeah.
Thank you so much. It is such a pleasure to speak to you.
I am
one of those persons that accidentally found Radiant Radio.
Radiant Radio?
Channel Surfing. Radiant Radio, yes.
Relevant.
Channel Surfing and Relevant, excuse me. And I can't stop listening to you guys, all of you, every day. And I love you. And
thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so happy to hear that. And I hope we have you for life, Jessica. All I ask personally is 3 hours of your day, every day. That's all I ask of you. Or Carmen, I should say.
Well, that's all
Thanks,
right.
Carmen.
That's all right. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much. I appreciate it. Now to where we're going, Jessica in Orange, California. Good morning, Jessica.
Hi, Patrick.
Hi.
I was wondering if the souls in purgatory can speak to us here on earth.
The short answer is if God permits it, but not otherwise. And there are examples in the life of the church where God has permitted the holy souls to come back to warn, for example, you know, to amend your life so that you don't wind up spending a lot of time in purgatory, because by all accounts, it's very rigorous and very painful. So yes, there have been instances where that's happened, but I would say the vast, 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 vast majority of the time, that doesn't happen. So they're in purgatory, and we have no, you know, direct interaction with them at all, other than praying for them, asking the Lord to shorten the time that they're there. Now, if you're interested in a book that will give you examples of this, I would recommend a book by Father F.X. Shoup, and I don't know how he would have pronounced it, but S-H-O-U-P-P-E, and it's a book called Purgatory, and he gives lots and lots of stories. These are true stories, true examples of where God permitted a soul to manifest, to ask for prayers or to warn people. Typically, it would be for those reasons. So that might be something to read if you want some examples.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're most welcome. Thank you. Let's see. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. You can call now. We have a line that just opened up. Call now, 888-914-9149. How about this story that I've been wanting to share with you? I wanted to get to it yesterday, but we ran out of time. The Babylon Bee, you may have heard of them. You may have seen them. It's a satirical website. It's Protestant, I believe. I think it's evangelical Protestant run and owned. And it's a trenchant, usually ironic and whimsical commentary on things going on in the world. Well, the Babylon Bee, they demanded a retraction last week from the New York Times over an article calling this Christian satirical outlet an example of a far-right misinformation site as defamation claims against the newspaper start to pile up. Now, this is courtesy of the Washington Times, and we'll have a link to this article posted so you can read it. Babylon Bee CEO Seth Dillon cited a March 19th New York Times article called "For Political Cartoonists, the Irony Was That Facebook Didn't Recognize Irony," which characterized the Babylon Bee as a website that, quote, used satire claims to protect their presence on the platform. Dillon, for his part, he's the CEO, as I said, of Babylon Bee. He said, "Yesterday, our counsel sent a letter to the New York Times demanding a retraction. We took this action because their article was and remains defamatory. For better or for worse," he said, "the New York Times is considered a reliable," he puts this in quote marks, "a reliable source. We cannot stand idly by as they act with malice to misrepresent us in ways that jeopardize our business." Dillon stopped short of threatening a lawsuit, but the Babylon Bee's news arm, not the Bee, that's an offshoot of theirs, hinted at legal action with the headline, "Lawyered Up Babylon Bee Accuses New York Times of Defamation, Demands Retraction." The New York Times did publish a clarification in March after being called out by the Babylon Bee, but Dillon says the update was no better than the original. The newspaper said in its update, "The Babylon Bee, a right-leaning satirical site, has feuded with Facebook and the fact-checking site Snopes over whether the site published misinformation or satire. Babylon Bee founder Adam Ford responded by saying that the update is still damning of us, especially given its context in the paragraph and article at large, and still precisely worded to cast doubt on the Bee's legitimacy as a satire outlet. What a joke. Dylan pointed out that Snopes revised the wording of a 2019 quote-unquote fact check, and issued an editor's note saying it was not their intent to impute, quote, deceptive intent on the part of Babylon Bee. Dylan says it's therefore misleading and malicious to characterize that incident as a feud, as if Snopes ever openly stood by the claim that we are misinformation and not satire. That's the essence of the whole thing here. They're trying to discredit the Babylon Bee, not by saying, well, their jokes aren't funny, and they are actually quite funny. They're trying to marginalize them. And I suppose if they had their wildest dreams come true, they'd like to get rid of them altogether, by insinuating that they are, in other words, there's the so-called alt-right or far-right extremist hate language that's masquerading as humor. That's the real thing that's going on here. And Babylon Bee, of course, is right to fight against that, because it's not true. They're using humor to critique popular culture. And it's just like we've seen in so many other instances where, like the teacher in Loudoun County, Virginia, he voiced an opinion that was contrary to the prevailing mores and agendas of the people in power, and they silenced him, or they tried to anyway. They didn't succeed. They tried to silence him. Somebody has an opinion on whatever. It could be vaccines. It could be where did the COVID-19 virus originate. Anything that you think might be worthy of a discussion, if it's deemed to be quote unquote far right or quote unquote alt-right, or, you know, some of those usually poorly used terms, poorly because they're not accurate often, they will just shut you down. They will silence you if they can do that. And they try so hard to do that. And that's what this is all about. It's yet another reason, if you ask me, that we should thank God every day for Relevant Radio. And I mean that absolutely sincerely. We should thank God every day that we have the freedom to speak on these issues and not have Jack Dorsey from Twitter shut us down, because he can't. Or not have Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook silence us because we have a view that's different from their view. I thank God for the freedom that we have. But you know what? Honestly, if we don't stand up and fight for our freedoms, if we don't stand up and speak out in favor of our freedoms, if we don't exercise our freedoms responsibly, obviously, then those freedoms could go away. I mean, who would have thought 10 years ago, when Twitter was still not all that well known and Facebook was not all that well known, you know, we see what behemoths they become in the meantime. But who would have thought maybe 10 or 15 years ago, oh, this is a cool place. I can, you know, post baby pictures here and we can have conversations with relatives we haven't seen in a long time. Who would have thought that that would get to the point where the people at the headquarters for Facebook and Twitter and other places, they would decide, they and their algorithms would decide what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say, or what you are allowed to think, or what you're allowed to see. Because if maybe some video promoting pro-life or something like that might get on your screen, that would be terrible. They don't want you to see that. They don't want you to be dissuaded maybe from a position that you might hold, but you might change from if more information came in your direction. Who would have thought that these, you know, masters of the universe who run these huge tech companies would exert so much control over the little guy like you? I'll tell you, 10, 15 years ago, I didn't see that coming. Did you, Cyrus? I know you were huge on MySpace for quite a long time. You may still be, for all I know. But I bet you didn't see that coming. Did you, Cyrus?
I saw nothing.
You sound like Sergeant Schultz from Hogan's Heroes. I know nothing.
I'm sticking with that.
All right. Okay, Sergeant Schultz. Thank you. By the way, a little TV trivia, Cyrus. The original pilot for Hogan's Heroes. You ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
This is the honest truth. Werner Klemperer, who played Colonel Klink, he originally was cast as Sergeant Schultz, and the guy who played Sergeant Schultz was the guy who was cast to be Colonel Klink. And they did the pilot, and they realized, or whoever realized, that it would be better to switch them, so they switched roles.
I did not know that.
True story. Go home and impress your children.
Fascinating.
With that information. They'll say, Hogan's who? They probably have never seen Hogan's Heroes. There it is. All right. Just in time with the music. Thank you, Cyrus.
Saved by the Bell.
Indeed. That'd be a good name for a TV show. We'll be right back right after this. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
At the intersection of faith and culture, The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Thank you for listening. My number is 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Philadelphia and talk to Chris. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Patrick, I just had two very brief questions concerning the gentleman who called earlier who had the transgender son who, as an adult son who became a woman. And you mentioned that he shouldn't be allowed, you know, to use the women's bathroom. Just two brief questions. Now, would you feel exactly the same way? This is hypothetical, but would you feel exactly the same way if this person happened to be your son?
I believe I would, yes.
Okay. I just wanted to get you your response on that. And the other thing I was going to ask you, it seems like this bathroom issue is in a no-win situation because if he tries to use the men's bathroom and he's dressed like a woman, he's probably going to be repelled there also.
Yeah. I know.
unfortunate
is probably not the right word for it, but
right.
it's a very difficult situation. And my heart goes out to these people. I mean, I feel compassion for them, and I don't want to see anyone hurt. I don't want to see anybody, you know, mistreated. I certainly don't. But that's what makes the situation so thorny, is how do you, on the one hand, seek to do right by a transgender person and protect that person and not put that person into a situation of jeopardy, and at the same time, do the same thing for everyone else. And I don't claim to have, you know, the solution. It seems to me that maybe at least in the short term, if more and more establishments, if this is a bathroom issue per se, then start building department stores and restaurants and things like that where the bathroom, you know, you may have like say four bathrooms and anybody can use any bathroom because it's one person at a time. I think that would be a reasonable accommodation and nobody's infringed upon. But where you
understand
got,
it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, That's kind of the way I'm trying to approach it. I want to be fair and compassionate to everybody, including to transgender people. I've got nothing against them. I don't look down upon them or anything like that. But at the same time, there is a real problem with this question. How do we resolve it? So I'm trying to think it through like everyone else.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thank you. I appreciate the call, Chris. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Bruce in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Bruce.
Patrick, great program again, as usual. Yeah, honestly, I think we're on borrowed time, Relevant Radio, any moral.
You know, it's hard to hear you, Bruce. Can you put your mouth close to the phone so I can make sure I hear what you're saying? Did you say we're on borrowed time? Is that what you said?
Relevant Radio and all moral organizations. Anyway, my question is, how aggressive should we Christians be when confronted with some of this craziness? I'm really wound up for Loudoun County. These parents getting involved with this issue on
the Tanner Cross, the teacher who got suspended.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, they're really getting aggressive. But how far do we go before?
Yeah.
You know,
I like the way Dr. Martin Luther King did it. He employed nonviolence. So that would be my first opening gambit. Would be how far do we go? Well, we don't go in the area of violence. We don't do that. We don't take up arms. We don't use violence to try to get our way. I would rule that out 100% always. So what is left before we got to that extreme point that we should never get to? Well, we have legal remedies. He took a legal route to get reinstated, and he was successful. I think that's good. Everything, he was speaking out in public, letters to the editor. But even those things, because of the prevailing, you know, the combined might of big tech and the media and the news, you know, big news, etc., it's so stacked against the little guy, you and I, that we can only do what we can do in our local setting. I don't advocate that we should go on the war path, or, you know, I don't advocate that we should, you know, be that we should stoop to the level that other people are doing, like trying to silence them or trying to forbid them from speaking. I believe in having a healthy exchange of ideas out in the open, and let's see which ideas prevail. I think that's the better way to do it. So in the meantime, up to and including if you had to file a lawsuit to defend yourself, I would say just turn away from it. Turn away from the things that you know are wrong. And if people are going to insist on being involved in that, okay, fair enough. That's up to them, and eventually they'll have to answer for it. But in the meantime, I don't have to participate. I don't have to be. I don't have to look at that. And I find that that is a kind of a self-preservation technique that has helped me in the past. And you know, beyond that, I would just say on a case-by-case basis, speak the truth in love and stand up for what's right when you can, and then just keep on pushing. You know what I mean? Keep on trucking.
You being a spiritual person, I know it is heavy on your heart. These people who have these crazy notions, these ideas and all that, they're just empty vessels, aren't they? You know, their heart is just lacking anything that's spiritual or God oriented, and that's so they fill it up with all this craziness, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm reminded of what we read in Jude chapter 1 verse 12. There's only one chapter, and it says it's referring to people as waterless clouds carried along by winds, fruitless trees in late autumn, twice dead and uprooted. And for many years, that passage has fascinated me. Waterless clouds. You know, we look to the sky for rain because we need rain. And what good does a cloud do you if it doesn't have any moisture in it? Certainly, if you're a farmer, it's not going to help you. Fruitless trees in late autumn, twice dead and uprooted. And I find often that when I look around and I see just the devastation that's taken place in so many areas, that a lot of the people behind this or involved in this remind me of those waterless clouds carried along by winds, fruitless trees in late autumn, twice dead and uprooted. So, you know, we obviously have to pray for them. And I'm sure you would agree with me on that, Bruce, right? That we have to pray for people. Yeah. They're not my enemies. I don't want enmity with anybody. I don't want to be rude or insensitive or uncompassionate to anybody. Not at all. I want that for me, and I want that for you, and they don't seem to be too willing to apply that in this direction, but that's okay. In the meantime, we just speak the truth in love and do the best we can, it seems to me.
Very good. I very much respect your spiritual wisdom.
Thank you, Bruce.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the phone call. Yes. Let's go now to, where are we going? Milwaukee. Let's talk to Mel in Milwaukee. Hi, Mel.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question. My son was married about 5 years ago in a Lutheran church to a Lutheran girl. And in the past month or so, he started going back to Mass because the pastor there was talking so bad about the Catholic Church.
Oh, boy.
And I know he's receiving the sacraments, and I'm wondering, is he able to receive the sacraments? Or?
Well, let me ask a couple questions. So he's been away from the church for some years then, right? He hasn't been practicing his
Right.
Faith. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Without knowing anything else, that right there poses a problem because even prior to COVID, or because of prior to COVID, the Sunday obligation was in force. If he missed Mass for 3 years, let's say 3.5 years, then that in itself is a serious sin. So he would need to get that cleared up. Even if that were the only serious sin he had committed, he would still have to go to confession to clear that up before he could receive Holy Communion. But my guess is, you know, people being people and life being life, there may have been other mortal sins that have piled up in the meantime. So what he would need to do to get back to a full participation in the faith, including receiving the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist, would be to go to confession. And it will be good for him. And it
he
would
did
probably...
go to confession.
Well, that's good
and,
to know.
And he did, it sounds like the priest said it was okay for him to receive the sacraments, but I always thought you had to be married in the church or have the church blessed, the marriage blessed by a priest.
Well, that's the other thing, and I was going to ask you about that, because in some cases, a Catholic can get permission to be married, let's say, in a Lutheran church. That dispensation can be granted, but I didn't have a chance to ask you whether or not he asked for that. I'm guessing he probably didn't ask
no,
for that,
he
right?
did not.
Okay.
No, he did not.
So in that case, he has an objectively invalid marriage, which requires
right.
obviously what you were talking about, the blessing of the church, and that can be had as well. Is his wife amenable to having their marriage blessed by the Catholic Church?
She's not very amenable to really anything.
Hmm. Doesn't mean she has to become Catholic. It just means that she
right.
would be willing to have the marriage blessed, convalidated.
I don't know. I don't think mm-hmm. so, but maybe.
Well, that would be my suggestion then. If I were your husband, or you know, my wife and I were in your position, we would say, here's how you can resolve this and everybody's happy. So your wife doesn't have to stop being Lutheran. It'd be great if she became Catholic, but if that's not in the cards, okay. But if you have your marriage blessed, and what that would mean in terms of a convalidation is they would publicly express their marriage vows and the public granting of consent one to the other. And that would be in the presence of typically it'd be a parish priest, but it could be a deacon or it could be a bishop. And there would be two witnesses there, and their marriage would become sacramental ipso facto, in which case then it wouldn't really affect her life other than the fact that she's doing something to make her husband happy. He's now in a position of being able to receive the Holy Eucharist without having to worry about this objective problem that he's got right now. So that's the way I would promote.
So until then, he shouldn't be receiving the sacrament.
He should not be, no.
I didn't think so. I don't understand why priests are telling everyone they can receive the sacrament.
Well, I don't know about that. It depends on the priest, obviously. I share your concern if it's a priest who is trying to be a nice guy and tell somebody something they want to hear. That's not good. You got to tell them the truth. Sometimes the truth is difficult, but the truth, as Jesus said, will set you free. So why not just tell the truth and let the person have a real chance at holiness? So in order of what I would do, if I were your son, I would say, okay, let's get our marriage convalidated. I would really talk to her, the wife, about getting that. And if she agrees to it, then I would proceed with that. He can take the step, and heroic couples do this. It can be done. It's not easy, but it can be done. And that is, they could live as brother and sister until such time as they got this convalidated. But if they're not waiting on an annulment response or anything, then there really is no great length of time that would go by. They could have this done this weekend if they wanted to do so. So if he did that, excuse me, and then he were to go to confession again and make a good, complete confession, then he would be good to go. And he would be in a position to start really digging back into his Catholic faith. I hope that's how it happens, Mel. Thank you. Let's go now to Mark, listening in Phoenix. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. My question is about the authoritative, whether CDF documents or documents from the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith are magisterial or not. As you know, that the CDF has issued documents saying, in no uncertain terms, priests shall not distribute communion to pro-life or pro-choice politicians. Mm-hmm. And then recently the document about priests cannot and shall not bless same-sex unions. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if those documents are magisterial, then it's pretty scandalous to have priests and bishops, cardinals, basically just ignore them, like they're just policy statements. But at the same time, if they aren't magisterial, that'd be helpful to know too. And, you know, what good is the magisterium if no one ever knows when it's invoked or not, or when it's forceful or not, you know, and we need them.
Okay, so let's dig into that. I'm just looking at the clock, and I'm afraid we'll run out of time. So for those who are not familiar with it, your use of the word magisterial refers to the church's magisterium, and that is from the Latin word for a teacher. So it's the teaching office of the church. And yes, the short answer is yes, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith is its output, especially when it's a formal document under the authority of the Pope or being promulgated at the request of the Pope. That is certainly magisterial. But the magisterium teaches on many different issues, and the magisterium also is involved in the church's law. So part of the office of the Bishop of Rome, the successor of St. Peter, is to be the supreme legislator, as the term goes, for the church's law. Now, that's directly connected with the magisterium because priests and deacons don't make canon law. The bishops do. And ultimately, the Pope himself is the one who would approve that. So these things are connected to the magisterium, and they are magisterial, but they're not always necessarily doctrinal. This is the key thing here. So there may be doctrinal or pastoral statements, magisterial statements that are made that are not necessarily doctrinal per se, but they impinge upon doctrine, or they're formed by doctrinal issues. So take, for example, the issue of canonical form for the sacrament of holy matrimony. Catholics are obliged to get married according to the church's canonical form, which includes being married in a church with two witnesses in front of one of the church's ministers, so it'd be a deacon, priest, or bishop. So the canonical form, when it's observed, leads to a valid marriage, and that in itself is the church's law, but it's connected to doctrine. I guess the point I'm trying to say, Mark, is that just because it's magisterial doesn't necessarily mean that it's doctrinal. Do you see the nuance there? Because that means that there are things that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith might say, or the Congregation for Divine Liturgy, or the Discipline of the Sacraments. I'm leaving something out, I'm sure. They can issue statements and directives and things that could be modified later. So, you know, if for example, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith tells an errant theologian, you're not allowed to speak or teach or write books right now. Okay, that's a disciplinary issue. It's not doctrinal, and it could change. But it's still magisterial. It's still coming from the magisterium of the church. I guess that's a roundabout way of answering your question. Does that make sense?
It does. I guess, you know, whether it's doctrinal or not, it's still binding, though, correct? And so there is a scandalous issue if people, especially priests and bishops, just ignore a document from the CDS.
Yeah, and there was an example of that I touched upon last year. I have a break I've got to take, Mark, so I'll leave it at this. And it had to do with the church's, you know, continuous reiteration of the fact that lay people have a right to receive Holy Communion on the tongue. And there were some, thankfully only a few, but there were some prelates who said, nope, you got to receive only on the hand. And so all the sources that people would point to said, no, even in times of plague, Catholics have a right to receive Holy Communion on the tongue. Well, it got so far that actually a dubium was sent to the Congregation for the Sacraments. And it was responded to that, yes, a bishop can say that this is that you must receive Holy Communion only on the hand. So that was a change. Whether or not that change will stay, we'll see. But up to that point, the church's continuous answer to that had been, no, you can't tell a Catholic that he can't receive Holy Communion on the tongue. And some people pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, and eventually they got the answer they wanted. So sometimes those things happen as well. I've got to take a break, though, Mark. Thanks for the phone call. I'll be right back right after this. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Let me park my Gran Torino. My dad used to have a Gran Torino, Cyrus. Did you know that? Back in the 70s?
No,
how would you know that? There'd be no way you could know that.
But I'm not surprised.
I tell you what, it was an awesome machine. And I know why he drove that. That was it. And this song reminds me of that. 888-914-9149 is the number. Let's go to Ernesto in the Central Valley of California. Good morning, Ernesto.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. So my question is, you read in Genesis where the Lord says that man is given 120 years. Mm-hmm. And then in Psalm 90:10, I believe, he says that we are given 70 years, unless by strength we go 80 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, I understand that. However, in Genesis, when he says that we are given 120 years, you then read about people who live 400 years and, mm-hmm. 300 years. So I'm not understanding, if he says we were given back then 120 years, why yeah. these people lived longer than that.
Okay. So there's no real conflict here. These are different ways of talking about the same thing, and they're not intended to be absolute. So as the Bible, as you pointed out, in the book of Genesis, we see that some of these figures, these personages, lived for many hundreds of years. It seems that Methuselah lived right. for nearly 1,000 years, we're told. So Genesis 6:3 is pointing out, it says, but his days shall be 120 years. That's sort of a general description of the average lifespan. So we used right. to talk about 70. So 70 is 70 years of age. And that was fairly common. I think the mortality, what's the word I want here? The age of mortality on average was even a little bit lower than that, but it didn't mean that nobody could live beyond 70 years. There were plenty of people who did live beyond 70 years, but by and large, on average, most people would live for about 70 years, in okay. those times. So that's what this is. This is a general description. It's not it's not an absolute decree that nobody can live longer than that. So when we see people who did live quite a bit longer, there really is no conflict. It's just they're the outliers.
Yeah.
They're the ones who were different from the norm.
Yeah. And I understand that, because nowadays, like it says, we're given 70 years on this by strength, we go 80. I understand that. But then you hear of plenty of people who live into, 100, 103, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And they are very few, and I understand that those are the outliers. It just, and I'm not suggesting that the Bible is giving any, trying to confuse a person or anything like that. No, mm-hmm. it's just in my mind.
Sure.
In Genesis, it says 120 years, but then they go well beyond 120 years. Okay, you would say, 120 years, general. So maybe he lived 125 or 130 or 135. Mm-hmm. Okay. But to go from that to 300 and 400 years seems like rather extreme. And so I'm thinking maybe these people were more closer to God it just posed the question in my mind.
It's a good question. It's good to ponder. It seems to me the best way to look at it is that by and large, most people lived to say 120 years in those days. Some people, few, but some lived quite a bit longer, but most people lived about that long. I would see it in that light.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll continue to think about it with your insight. I've spoken with you before a couple of times. I think you're a very intelligent man, and I thank you for that.
Thank you.
I will consider that. Maybe it'll work itself out in my goofy mind.
If you want some really interesting reading, I would suggest reading the Antiquities of the Jews by Flavius Josephus. You'll hear people call him Josephus. And okay. you can get this in English. He was a contemporary of the apostles, but he was a great historian, okay. a Jewish historian. And you know what's interesting is that in his Antiquity of the Jews, he starts with basically Adam and Eve, and he works his way forward, and he tells a lot of the details about the things we read about in the Old Testament that were carried through rabbinic tradition. So they were carried through oral tradition and even some of the things that were written down. So these are embellishments on what we see in Scripture, and you could take them or leave them. I mean, it's possible that some of these things are not entirely accurate, but what he does is he presents to you a great deal of information that the Jews possessed that are not recorded in Scripture that give fascinating details about Abraham and Moses and things like that. So that might be interesting reading for you as you ponder this topic.
Okay, Antiquities of the Jews.
Right, by Josephus. Or Josephus.
Yeah, Flavius right. Josephus, yeah.
Right.
Okay, it'll probably be, might be difficult to come across, but I'll see if I can
find it. Oh, it's super easy. It's super easy. You can order it on Amazon. I have a couple editions. One edition, I have all the collected works of Josephus in a single volume. It's a big, thick brick of a book, but it's handy because everything's in there. But you can easily get this. And
okay.
Yeah, it is quite interesting. Well, thank you, Ernesto. Nice to talk to you again. 888-914-9149. Now we go to Louise in Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning. Okay, I had a question about, well, I guess I wanted your opinion on the Christeros War, since you had made the comment that you didn't think it was right to use violence. And
right.
I know that period gave us several saints, a lot of martyrs, and I'm not one to promote violence, but I'm not one to sit by the side if I see my priest hanging from a rope in my church.
Okay, well, I did a, this may interest you, I did a one-hour presentation on this very topic, on the Christeros, and I brought to bear a lot of the history, much of it unknown by most people anyway. So I have a very clear understanding of what they did and why they did it. And I am sympathetic to the fact that they felt like they had no other choice but to take up arms to fight against the government that was outlawing the Catholic faith and killing people wholesale. I understand it. They did what they felt they had to do. It's easy to second guess people, especially after the fact, but I don't retreat from my view, my conviction that we still should avoid using violence. And I take as in my example the early Christians, and I'd like you to ponder this. You talk about your priest hanging from a rafter in the church because he was killed, martyred. Okay, look at the early martyrs in the early church, and we have countless examples of bishops, well, popes for that matter, and bishops and priests and lay people being slaughtered left, right, and center. And the one thing we don't ever see is an armed uprising by the Christians. They don't take up swords and spears and go after the Roman soldiers. They would have been mown down immediately. We don't see an armed response. We see the martyrs. We see the tortures. We see all of the things that were, and worse than were taking place in Mexico in the 1920s and teens. But we don't see the Christians rising up in an armed way to stop them. I see that as the answer to the question. The apostles did not encourage people to take up arms and stop the Jews and the Romans from oppressing them. In fact, Jesus, he specifically gave a thumbs down to the zealots who wanted exactly that. The zealots, you know, Barabbas seems to have been part of their party. They were zealous Jews who wanted to use force to overthrow the Roman occupiers, and Jesus said no. He said no in more than one way. In other words, no, I'm not joining you. I'm not going to be your guy, your figurehead. And he also reminded the apostles that are blessed are the peacemakers. So I take those cues as part of my position that we should never resort to violence. I think those are very powerful, in at least in how I look at it. What do you think about that, Louise?
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of confused. I mean, I'm not a violent person, but I just think there's a time when you have to stand up and not be milquetoast. So,
true. I mean, we went to war against Adolf Hitler, and rightly so. We went to war against Al-Qaeda, and rightly so. You have the right to defend yourself and your family if somebody's coming through the window at 3 a.m. intent upon harming you. You have the right to use even lethal force if necessary. So I'm not excluding those situations. I'm not excluding self-defense. but...
No, and I'm not either. I'm just trying to see where we draw the line on religious freedoms as we lose them more and more every day.
Well, I look to the early church. I look to the apostles in the early church for their example. And one thing I can say with certitude is that they did not endorse or take part in armed insurrection against the Roman government, against the very people who were rounding them up and feeding them to the lions. To me, that speaks very loudly. And to whatever extent we get close to that kind of situation, I hope we don't, but I will look to them for my encouragement on how to handle it.
Okay. Thank you very much. That
You're
was
welcome,
very helpful.
Louise. Thank you. Nice chatting with you.
Bye.
And we are, Cyrus, I know you're going to play a Dirty Harry thing, so I won't even ask you if there's time to go.
Man!
Because you got your finger right there.
Aw, come on, man.
I've been trained. Man has to know his limits. Man's got to know his limitations, right?
Come on, man.
I know. Well, I've learned my lesson, and so I'm not going to go to another phone call, but I will do that when we come back from this quick timeout. We just had a line open up. Call it 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Come on!